H2. It's not going to alter real work. And it's also, in a precise sense, unaffected by measurements on S2. The precise sense being from the perspective of someone who has access to S1 but doesn't have access to S2, doesn't have access to the measurement data, is ignorant of the outcomes of those measurements. Carrying out measurements on S2 will not affect O1. Corollary of that, and absolutely crucial corollary of that, is that there's no way for two people at space-like separations, each of them controlling one of the systems, there's no way for either of them to send a signal to the other one by carrying out some quantum operation, unitary evolution or measurement, on the system under their control, in the hope of influencing directly what the person looking at the other system can observe about that system. They can't send signals because whatever they do here, they're not going to change row one here, so they're not going to change the physics of S1. So no experiments that A over here carry out will be altered, even statistically, its outcomes won't even be statistically affected by any actions. Were people happy with that argument? Are people happy with that argument? Because it's really one of the key things that you need to extract from those discussions. Any questions? Okay. So let me stress, although a particularly strong motivation for the discussion is the case where S1 and S2 are isolated, we're also often very interested in situations where S1 and S2 are interacting. And a lot of what we said, particularly all the mathematics defining reduced density matrices, row 1 and row 2, applies equally well in that case. So we have a situation in which, for instance, S1 is some quantum system that we're working on in the laboratory, and we could represent the environment, all the stuff, all the photons and cosmic rays and other stuff that's coming in and potentially messing up our experiment. We can represent that as S2. And here, of course, the whole point is that S1 and S2 are not isolated. We have to worry about stuff that we would rather be able to screen off but can't completely screen off, the photons and the cosmic rays in the environment. On the other hand, we don't have direct control over them. We don't have direct access to them. So we have to do physics as best we can with a state through analyzing the state of the thing that is under our control, S1. And we will need the reduced density matrix, and we'll need to understand what happens to the reduced density matrix in these circumstances in order to do that. That's a comment for future reference. I'm going to come back to that point. But I want to stress straight away that the formalism that we've set out here has more general applications than the case that we've currently been focusing on of S1 and S2 isolation from each other. There's a question that feeds into this one. Do you mean a perfectly isolated system? How do you screen it off from everything in the environment? I think that's probably impossible. You could do your best, of course. You could put it inside a Faraday cage. You can get the temperature as low as possible, but you.
But then do you assume that say S1 is the thing you're looking at and S2 is the environment, or S1 is...
Oh, right. So this... This kind of depends on the context and on how well isolated these things are. So in the sort of experiments we're about to discuss, for instance, you create an entangled pair of photons and they separate, and we're going to call one photon S1 and the other one S2. In that circumstance, it's still true in principle. They're not completely isolated from the environment.
But the interactions with the environment are pretty much negligible. And so we're going to treat them, we're going to effectively neglect the environment. Reason for that is that photons interact pretty weakly with everything else. On the other hand, if you're trying to build a quantum computer, decoherence is a very difficult problem to deal with. The interactions with the environment are very, very difficult to deal with. And it would simply be an error to try and neglect the environment. You have to deal with the interactions with the environment and understand its influence on the system. So in the end, you have to sort of proceed phenomenologically. It's a mixture of theoretical intuition and actual experimental testing to see under what situations you can pretty much ignore the environment, and under which situations you just have to take account of it because it's affecting physics. But in principle, what you say is right. There is no perfect isolation. You can never get the temperature of the environment to zero. And even if you could, you can never screen off the gravitational interactions. Any more questions? On the other hand, while we can't perfectly screen off anything from the environment, we may be able to do it very well, we can guarantee for a finite duration that S1 and S2 are not influencing one another. And one way we could do that is simply by having them at space-like separated locations throughout the experiment. So the idea here is, bring down another one of these. So the experiment's going to start at this point in time, and it's going to finish at this point in time. And this is space, and light rays are sort of going roughly 45 degrees, say like so. And here's S1 at the start. And I guess there's its world tube. And here's S2 at the start. If we start out with S1 and S2 in some state that for whatever reason we're confident we can capture, maybe it's a pure joint state, perhaps it's a mixed one. At any rate, we start out knowing the state of S1 and S2, and we perform an experiment during this interval on S1 and this interval on S2. We could be confident that at least during those windows, there can be no interaction between S1 and S2 because it would violate locality. The time for any information about the state of S2 to propagate by any means, through quantum theory, if quantum theory is correct, but in principle by any means to S1, would take us to at least here, by which time the experiment's finished. So we can, assuming very little else except for Minkowski causality, at least temporarily ensure isolation of the two systems. So in that situation, assuming that we're justified in restricting our attention to S1 and S2, assuming interactions with everything else are relatively negligible, the reduced density matrix, rho 1 for S1, encodes all the information that's going to be available to A throughout the experiment, and nothing that B does on S2 during B's experiment, which lasts from here to here, can possibly affect rho 1. So this is, to underline again, this is the sense in which we see a consistency between quantum theory and special relativity, even for measurements on entangled systems, even for the one place where it looks initially as though there might possibly be a problem. Whatever operations B carries out on S2, despite the fact that S1 and S2 states may well be entangled, give no way of superluminal signaling. Yeah?
You do a measurement on one of these, well, at the same time, I mean, it would change the state of the other one.
So this is the crucial point, and we should certainly focus on this. We need to distinguish between two different ways of doing the calculation. One of them, B carried out a measurement on S2, and we take account of the outcomes of that measurement, and we look at what that does to our description of the state for S1. That's the point that you're pressing at the moment, right? The other way of doing the calculation, B carries out a measurement on S2, but we look at the information actually available to A, who's got S1. That information does not include the outcomes. And because of that, we have to go through the calculation we went through last time to see what happens to the reduced density matrix for S1 from A's perspective, from the perspective of the person ignorant of the outcomes, in order to understand what they can possibly extract as a result of B carrying out the measurement. And we saw last time the effect is zero. Rho 1 is unchanged from the perspective of A.
But we have something that goes faster than light, but we cannot see anything with it, but it goes
faster. I love this line of questioning. We're going to pursue this discussion further, indeed. Here's maybe one way of saying what I think you might be saying. B can't send a signal to A faster than light. We're agreed on that. In the sense that operationally, right, whatever B does, no experiment that A does will be able to pick up information about what B did. That we're agreed. On the other hand, it looks from the quantum formalism as though something could be you might even say it more strongly. It looks to you from the quantum formalism as though something is being transmitted superluminally by nature. Even if A can't pick it up, even if there's no way operationally to send signals, it looks as if there's something superluminal about the process underlying the experiment.
It is, I guess.
Hmm?
It is. It's not that the case of, well, for example, if there are two spins, one were up at the beginning and one down, if they were both in the quantum state, I mean, And when we measure the one, the other changes simultaneously. Not that from the beginning they were something like a mixture or something.
In the mathematics, in the way we've set it out so far, what you say is absolutely correct. That's going to lead us very shortly onto pressing a rather important question. How directly does the mathematics correspond to reality, to physics? After all, I can write down all sorts of calculational ways of predicting the results of experiments. It would be wrong to insist that everything in my calculation must have a direct representative in reality. Every time I write down a plus sign, there must be some sort of real plus operator sitting inside nature that it represents. So, on the other hand, if our mathematics is completely divorced from reality, then it's whatever we're doing, it's not theoretical physics. So we need to investigate further this link between the mathematics of the calculations and what is or might be actually happening in the world out there. And I'm so glad you asked this question because it leads straight into the next bit of the discussion. Let me move forward and we'll see more about this. So let's refresh our memories about this, the example you just raised, in fact, a simple example, the singlet. Remember that we, if we have two spin half particles, we have a total of a four-dimensional Hilbert space, 2 times 2. We can split that up into the triplet state and the singlet state. And there's nothing magical about the singlet state. It has some particularly nice properties, and we tend to use it in preference, for instance, to this one, just because the mathematics is a tiny bit simpler. But really, the only thing that's crucial for our discussion is that we're dealing with an entangled state. The singlet is entangled, fine. It's also got nice properties, so let's use it. But we could carry through the whole discussion with this state, for instance, or indeed any other entangled state. Let's focus on the singlet, mainly because it's rotationally invariant. Let's look at a situation in which A and B each have one spin half particle under their control, and they are indeed space-like separated, and we can neglect the interactions with the rest of the universe. We don't need to worry about the environment to good enough approximation. It's not going to matter for us. What happens to the joint state if B measures, for instance, sigma 3? Well, B will get outcome up with probability 1/2, outcome down with probability 1/2. From B's perspective, applying the projection postulate, after that measurement's been carried out, the joint state is either down up or up down. So as you've already been stressing, from B's perspective, A's state is altered by B's measurement. From A's perspective, AE is unaware, let's assume, that B's going to carry out the measurement, but is ignorant of the outcome of the measurement. Here's the joint state. Here's the density matrix before the experiment. Here's the density matrix after B carries out the measurement, the reduced density matrix on A's side afterwards. And it's exactly the same as the reduced density matrix before. As we calculate that in general, but we can check it in a line for the singlet. So I'd like to open up another set of slides in a minute. So no superluminal signaling. Nonetheless, we see a correlation of the spin measurement outcomes. And let me just quickly open this up. Reinforce this. It will come in a minute, but let me move forward while it's waiting. I did whole page and full screen. Well, that's something. It doesn't quite seem to like that either. But it's better than the alternative. All right, thank you. So just to recap, in this example, we've got the person on the left carrying out the measurement of SZ. Those are the outcomes. If we now measure SZ on the right-hand particle, then with certainty we'll either get spin up if the person on the left got spin down, or spin down if the person on the left got spin up. There's a perfect anticorrelation between those measurements. So in particular, if the person on the left knows that the person on the right is going to carry out the measurement after they carry out their own, they could predict in advance what the outcome of that measurement will be if the measurements are both at the same spin. So the person on the left is going to measure SZ first. If they know in advance that the person on the right is also going to measure SZ, they can predict with certainty the outcome. For some reason, it doesn't want to stop doing this now.
Select something else.
Select reading view, for instance. Thank you. Aha. Okay, let's see if the PowerPoint is up. There we go. And we can generalize that, of course. Suppose we're going to have two successive measurements, one on the left, one on the right, of two different spins. Spin about the A-axis on the left, spin about the B-axis on the right. After the person on the left carries out their measurement, from their perspective, the state changes either to up, left, down, right, about the axis they carry out the measurement, or the other way around, depending on the outcome. If the person on the right then carries out a measurement about a different axis, B, they will get an anti-correlated outcome with, in other words, the opposite outcome, with probability cos squared theta over 2, where theta is the angle between the two axes, A and B. And all we need to do to understand that is to represent their state, their down A or up A state, in the basis of the eigenstates for the sigma B measurement. And we say, for instance, if their state is effectively down A, they measure down B, sorry, they measure the spin about B, with probability sine squared theta over 2, they get outcome down, with probability cos squared theta over 2, they get outcome up. If the outcome's the other way around, it's essentially the same calculation, just with the signs of the spins reversed. One of these little mysteries.
Page width? Maybe page width.
Page?
That's about the whole page.
Page width. Well, that does something. That doesn't work so well. I may just have to skip those two slides. Okay. So, our discussion is leading us to a point that was first raised in the 1930s by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. We agree now that we can't operationally send superluminal signals. We can't through these experiments find a way of superluminal signals. But it still looks as though nature is doing, or could possibly be doing, exactly that. The mathematics of our calculations suggests that the description of A's state changes as soon as B's carried out a measurement. And indeed, the reduced density matrix, from B's perspective, A's reduced density matrix does change, even though, crucially, from A's perspective, it doesn't. So this led Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen to write a paper asking this rather pressing question. Can the quantum mechanical description of physical reality be considered complete? And they started basically from the intuition we've already touched on. It looks as though there's something superluminal here. And they tried to flesh it out. They tried to think very carefully about the relationship between the mathematics of quantum theory, or more generally, any possible physical theory, and the underlying physical reality. So underlying this whole argument is the assumption that it makes sense to talk about physical reality. They were comfortable with that. Every point in their argument is open to discussion, open to debate, open to criticism. So I don't think we're forced to accept even that starting premise, that there is an objective physical reality that whose properties we're trying to uncover. On the other hand, I think it's a clearly well-motivated and interesting premise to start from. And what we want to do is to look at the premises, run through the argument, and see where it leads, rather than prejudging each point individually. At least that would be my answer. So the idea is there is an external physical reality. The aim of theoretical physicists in the end is to describe it as well as possible. And as how do you know whether you succeed in that aim? Well, here's a criterion, the first criterion they gave. If you have a complete physical theory, and maybe, of course, we only have a provisional one that's missing the ingredients, but if you have a complete one, everything that's out there in the world, every element of physical reality, must have a counterpart in your physical theory. For everything that's out there in the world, there must be something in your mathematics that you could point to and say, this bit of the mathematics, that describes that bit of reality. And then their second criterion is a way of identifying what necessarily must be elements of that physical reality by a criterion that relates them to experiments. So let me first quote them and then try and elaborate a little bit. The second criterion is this. If we have a system and we don't disturb it in any way, so without in any way disturbing it, we can already predict with certainty, with probability one, the value of some physical quantity of that system, then that value was real. There exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. There's something over there. If I can leave it well alone, but say for sure what you would get if you did carry out a measurement on it, it must be the case that there was an objective fact of the matter in reality corresponding to that measurement outcome. I will push forward and I will elaborate with examples, but are there questions at this point? Are there any responses to EPR's criteria, EPR's argument? Or worries about where we're going, or whether any of this makes sense? Okay.
The first one is something that's reasonable in every way. You wouldn't be able to break it. But the second one seems a bit not necessarily always true. But it's in a way, it could be. Is it something based on an intuition, and doesn't have to be true?
Doesn't have to. I mean, I guess even the first one. I suppose you could take the first one as a definition of a complete theory. I mean, maybe. So you could keep in mind the possibility no complete theory exists. We don't know that there is a complete theory. But if we have something that deserves the name complete, this is what we mean by it. The second one, okay. I mean, I agree. I absolutely agree with you. You can make whatever demands you like on nature, but nature doesn't have to respect them. And this is clearly an intuition. It's not a logical. Is there some force to the intuition there? Does it seem like something that one would? Does it seem like a reasonable hypothesis to try and run with and test? Yeah. So what happens if we go back to our discussion of measurements on the singlet and apply EPR's criteria? Now let me try this one more time, just in case it's recovered.
Down there, right?
Something. Quick. Ah, that's what we wanted for the spins. Okay, there they go. Good. Thank you. So we start out with the spin singlet state, two spin half particles shared on the left and right. The person on the left could carry out a measurement of SZ. And if they do, either they get spin up, in which case quantum theory tells them that the joint state is now the product state on the left, or they get spin down, in which case it tells them it's the product state on the right. Perfect anticorrelation. So from the perspective of the person on the left, they're in a position where they can make with certainty predictions about the outcome of specific measurements of the person on the right. If they get this outcome, they can say, if R now measures spin down, I know for sure. If R measures spin along the z-axis, I know for sure they will get the answer down. And if they get the other outcome, they make the opposite prediction, but again with certainty. So either way, they're certain of the outcome of a measurement that will be made on the right before that measurement has taken place. So it appears from that last result that the person on the left can predetermine the outcome of a measurement of sigma z on the right, and yet they never touched the right-hand system. They never even went near it. They carried out measurements only on their own system over there. It appears as though then a measurement of sigma z on the right satisfies EPR's criterion. Remember, if without any way of disturbing the system, we can determine with certainty the outcome of a measurement on it, there must be an element of physical reality. So if we accept the EPR criterion, there must be an element of physical reality determining the outcome of sigma z on the right. But of course, that argument generalizes. The person on the left could have carried a measurement of the spin about any axis, not necessarily z, but any axis they liked. And if they did, they would be able to predetermine the outcome of a measurement on the right for that axis. So it now looks as though we have elements of physical reality corresponding to all possible spin measurements on the right. predetermining outcome. Measurements of sigma dot A on the right for all axes A. And of course, we could generalize this further. There was nothing special about the left, the person on the left. We could equally well run the argument the other way around. The person on the right carry out a measurement. If they do that, they can with certainty predetermine the outcome of the corresponding measurement on the left. And that's true for all possible measurements of all possible spin axes. So not just for all spin measurements on the right, but also for all spin measurements on the left. If we accept the EPR criteria, we're forced to the conclusion that there is something there's an objective fact of the matter in advance of any experiment being carried out, determining the outcome of those spin measurements for all axes for both wings. So Einstein was troubled by quantum theory from its inception. He went through a series of debates with Bohr in which he first looked for active inconsistencies in quantum theory. The experiment we discussed last time, the double slit experiment with the slits on wheels, was one of the experiments that was raised in those debates. Einstein had in his intuition felt that there was something wrong with quantum theory. And he spent a lot of the second half of his career trying to put his finger on what it could be. So he started by looking for inconsistencies. By the 1930s, he shifted or at least added a new perspective. And the EPR paper was the most famous and the most notable really outcome of that line of investigation. Maybe quantum theory isn't consistent, but it's missing something. Surely it's incomplete. Here's an argument to say it's incomplete. And I think it's a great paper, the EPR paper. It was a paper that was much neglected for most of its life to date. Now has 532 citations. I think up to, I have the graph here. These blue triangles plot citations per year in Physical Review of the EPR paper. I think the total figure up to about 1990 was less than 100, and then it took off. And it's one of the most dramatic examples of what the author of this review termed a sleeping beauty, a paper that is more or less neglected for a long, long, long time, and then suddenly comes to be appreciated. It was really only the rise of interest in quantum information and quantum foundations in the 1990s that led to a revival of interest in EPR's argument and further experimental tests of arising from EPR. So yeah, indeed, the figures are there on the right. 82 citations up to 1990, 500 odd in the next 13 years. So to be fair, another reason why the EPR paper didn't get as much attention as it could and I think should is that it didn't, in the form in which they presented their argument, it didn't immediately seem to lead anywhere. You had a question, can quantum theory be considered complete? You had an argument to suggest that it couldn't, if you accept the EPR criteria. But there wasn't really any way to resolve the question. And it wasn't until Bell's work in the 1960s that the link was made between the EPR argument and experiment. And Bell, it was really Bell who pointed out the crucial advantages that we get if we look at what's in fact a much simpler case of entanglement, the entanglement of two spin half particles, rather than position momentum entanglement, which was the case that EPR looked at in their original paper. So let's sort of telescope all that discussion a little bit and try and press from what seems like a metaphysical demand of EPRs to the possibility of an experimental test. Suppose they're right. Then it must be the case that the outcome of all the spin measurements on the left, all the spin measurements on the right, are predetermined before any experiment has been carried out on either wing. So let's consider some possible measurements we can carry out. And it's going to be enough just to consider a couple. So on the left over here, we have two possible spin measurements. Let's call them capital A1 and A2. And on the right, we have two more, call them B1 and B2. EPR are telling us there must be some fact of the matter, even before we do the experiment, about the results. So let's use the conventions that spin up about any given axis corresponds to plus one, spin down to minus one. Call the results little a and little b in obvious notation. So objectively, there is this thing, A1. It's plus or minus one. It tells us the outcome of measurement of capital A1. Here's A2, which tells us the outcome of the alternative measurement that we could have carried out, capital A2, and likewise on B. So we could, just as theorists, ask questions about the relationship between those values. So, and here's a possible set of questions we could ask. Are the top two unequal? And I want to use dotted lines for unequal and solid lines for equal. So are these two unequal? Are these two unequal? Are these two unequal? And are these two equal? They're just numbers, so these are perfectly fair questions to ask, and they must have some well-defined answer. And it's clear, given this set of questions, there's some constraint on the number of yes answers we can possibly get here. If A1 doesn't equal B1, and B1 doesn't equal A2, well then A1 has to equal A2. And so if A1 doesn't equal B2, well, A1 equals A2, so A2 can't equal B2 either. So we can't get yes, 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 and yes. We can get the first three, but then we get a contradiction with the last one. Likewise, we can't get yes. We can't get no, 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 no. We'll again get a contradiction. And although it's less important, in fact, we have to get an odd number of yeses. We can't get two yeses and two noes. So let's see. Can we get three yeses? Yes, we can. For instance, if I take A1 equals plus one and A2 equals plus one and B1 equals minus one and B2 equals minus one, then all these unequal relations are correct. I've got plus one over here on both sides for both of those and minus one over here. So three unequals, but this equality doesn't help. I can get three yes answers. I can't get four. So what? Well, that would be immediately helpful if we could do an experiment and test all of these relationships simultaneously. But of course we can't. These two numbers correspond to the outcomes of different possible spin measurements we could carry out. And they're measurements about different axes. The spin operators don't commute. Once we carry out one of them, we change the state. And we presumably, in general, change whatever the allegedly predetermined answer of the other measurement would be. So we have to address the question more indirectly. What we could do is make a random choice in any given experiment and at least build up statistics. So we, at any given run, we're going to choose randomly from these two. let's say with 50-50 chance randomly from these two. So let's say we measure A1 and B2. Well, then we could test this relation. Is what A1 not equal to B2? And we could do this lots and lots of times, build up statistics, and look at the number of times that we get a positive answer. So, under the assumption that these outcomes are predetermined, in other words, AVPR's criteria are correct, what's our distribution got to satisfy? It's got to be the case that the probability of getting a yes answer is less than or equal to 3/4. One time in four, we're going to pick a question to which the answer is no, at least one time in four. And it's also got to be greater than or equal to 1/4. At least one time in four, we're going to pick a question to which the answer is yes. And if you want to phrase that more symmetrically, okay, the difference between the probability and a half has to be less than or equal to 1/4. So that's a concrete prediction. It may look like a rather simple prediction, but it's a concrete prediction. What does quantum theory tell us? Well, quantum theory tells us the probability of getting anti-correlation, which is what we're really asking about in these first three cases, or correlation in the fourth case, depends on the angle between the relevant axes. And we already did that calculation. We've got a singlet. You carry out a measurement of SA on the left, SB on the right. What's the probability of anti-correlation? It's this, 1 minus sine squared theta over 2, or cos squared theta over 2. So we have complete freedom in deciding which axes we're going to choose to represent A1 and A2 and B1 and B2. And if one's starting from scratch, one plays about with that freedom and tries to look at the range of sets of correlations and the corresponding probabilities for getting the answer yes for different choices. And if you do that, you'll find that this particular set of choices maximizes the probability of getting the answer of yes. So A1 is spin measurement about this axis, A2 this axis, and B1 and B2 are offset by pi over 4 from those. So that we have angle pi over 4 here, here, and here. What's the probability that A1, the outcome, little a1, doesn't equal B1? That's the probability of anti-correlation between spin measurements about this axis and this axis. So the angle's pi over 4, we need cos squared pi over 8, which is 1 minus 1 over 2 root 2. What about A1 and B2? Same calculation in the opposite direction. What about A2 and B1? Same calculation again. And the last one, A2, B2, it's a different calculation. We now have 3 pi over 4. But it's essentially the same number. We've just changed our conventions for... Let me say that differently. The probability of anticorrelation is now cos squared 3 pi over 8 instead of cos squared pi over 8. And so the probability of correlation is cos squared pi over 8. And there is... which is fine, which is this number. So if we add together these four probabilities, we obtain the probability of yes for a random choice to be a half 1 plus 1 over root 2. I'm just slightly worried by thing on this. think, sorry, I think I have that wrong on that. That's the correct expression from cos squared pi over 8.
Is it a half of 1 plus 1 over
2? 1 over, you're right, it's half.
It would be 1.
Yeah, there's a factor of a half should have been outside the. Thank you. Sorry for the algebra. Okay, so to read that again, the probability of the first three anticorrelations is cos squared pi, right? The probability of the fourth pair being correlated is the same number, cos squared pi over 8. Each of these probabilities is equal. And so the probability of getting a yes for any random choice is that number. It doesn't really matter which choice we make. What is that number explicitly? It's 0.853 and loose change. It's larger than 3/4. So quantum mechanics tells us a different answer from the one we inferred from the EPR criterion. And not just a marginally different answer either. There's a significant gap between 0.75 and 0.85. So we have wiggle room for experimental error, and we have a theory that's worked brilliantly in lots of other contexts, quantum theory, that predicts one answer. We have a well-motivated line of argument by EPR that predicts a different answer. Obviously, we need to put it to experiment to test. So the possibility of experimental test was evident as soon as Bell published his theorem. And experiments did begin to be carried out in the late 60s and the 1970s. I'm not going to review every experiment that was, but I wanted to touch on just a few of the more famous and more conclusive ones. So that maybe the first landmark in many people's minds was an experiment by Alan Asper and collaborators that was published in 1982. What they did, which hadn't been achieved in previous experiments, was to ensure, at least in a particular sense, that the choice of measurement for the spin axes was made randomly in real time during the experiment, at points here for the one on the left, points here for the one on the right. And the reason for doing that was to try and exclude the possibility that information about the choice of measurement on the left was somehow available to the system on the right before it decided which way to give its answer. Remember, the EPR argument is talking about things, elements of physical reality, that are not there in quantum theory. It's looking for some deeper underlying theory that involves new physics. If we're going to take that argument seriously at all, we have to, at least as far as possible, take seriously the possibility that new physics might allow new ways for information to be transmitted that we're currently unaware of. There are new variables out there, there are new physical quantities out there. It could be the case that if we decide ahead of time that we're going to carry out a measurement about a particular spin axis over here, and we decide ahead of time, and that's encoded in the physics of the experimental apparatus sitting over here, it could be the case that this new underlying theory allows that information to be carried across to the right and changes the predetermined elements of reality, elements of physical reality, that are going to determine the outcomes of experiments on the right. So to avoid that possibility, what we want to do, ideally, is to assume that our choices of measurements on both the left and the right are made at points that are actually space-like separated from each other. And whatever the underlying physics is that we're testing, as long as it respects special relativity, it's unable to propagate information about our choice on the left in time to alter the outcome, alter the elements of physical reality on the right, and therefore the outcome of the measurements on the right, and vice versa. So I said that Aspe's experiment involved pseudo-random choices. To elaborate on that a little bit, what's actually sitting inside here is something like a cell filled with water that has a standing pressure wave set up so that at some point in the wave cycle we have low density, high density, low density, high density alternating, and then the half wavelength through the cycle we have equal density throughout the system, and then it goes back to oscillating low, high, low, high. So depending on whether the photon hits here or here, it will either propagate, and I'm conveying the spirit rather, I think, rather than precise physics of the, it will either propagate in one direction, let's say straight through, or it will be refracted because of this alternating sequence of low and high densities, and will emerge in a different direction. And so, and we have set up devices to measure the polarization, the photon version of spin in this experiment, about different axes, depending on which direction the photon emerges. So let me draw one picture. It can either come out here or here. If it comes out here, we measure sigma dot A1. If it comes out here, we measure sigma dot A2. Put a device aligned one way here and another way here. So this is random in the sense that it seems rather arbitrary, and it seems hard to believe that the photon is aware in advance of the state of this standing wave before it enters this cell. On the other hand, it is still a deterministic process. We, in principle, can predict at any given time what state the cell will be in. A hypothetical physical theory underlying quantum theory can surely reproduce those predictions. You can still worry, and this is going to be a recurring theme in these experimental tests. You can still worry that, in principle, the information about which way the wave is going to be when the photon hits, and so which way the photon is going to go, and so which measurement is going to be carried out, is available in the microphysics on the left, and is somehow propagated to the system on the right. It looks hard to believe, it looks conspiratorial, but it's clear that we can't eliminate it as a logical possibility. For that reason, among others, people have carried on trying to close that loophole as far as it can be closed. Trying to do more elaborate experiments. Let me first give the data from the Aspe experiment. The predictions of quantum theory, I'm afraid, are hardly visible on this, but they're little microscopic dots, something like that. The experimental data are there in gray. The agreement with quantum theory is extremely good, and the disagreement with EPR is more than statistically significant. It's 5 sigma away from agreement. So, can we do anything better than a pseudo-random choice of which spin axis to measure? Well, we can try. There's the one thing that comes to mind, I guess, is that we need a source of genuine randomness rather than pseudo-randomness. And if we believe that quantum theory gives us that, we believe that quantum measurements have genuinely randomly determined outcomes. So without claiming for a moment that this way of doing the experiment completely closes all logical possibility of a loophole, there's some motivation for trying to do an experiment in which the spin measurement, which way the photon goes or which way the spin measurement is set up, is determined pretty much at the point where the photon arrives by the random outcome of a quantum measurement. In real time, I'll elaborate on the in real time in a minute. So spin axis choice. So the idea here has to be that the two parties doing the two experiments, points Y and Z, get input from the quantum random number generators that are sitting with them that produce random numbers for each given run of the experiment at points in space and time that are space-like separated from one another and from the measurement, from the measurements on the other wing. So there have been several versions of this experiment. This one is by Weiss et al. In 2008. And an even more dramatic version, I'm going to flip forward a little bit, by some of the same authors, Scheidel and several collaborators, in 2010, did an experiment of this type in the Canary Islands, between two peaks, in Tenerife and La Palma, separated by nearly 150 kilometers. And it's so the space-like separations are almost invisible on the large scale. But if you look at the blown-up versions here, the random numbers are generated at these points A, and here's the point A at which Alice's random numbers are generated, and B for Bob's. And this point is space-like separated from B, and likewise little b is space-like separated from the point A at which Alice's measurement is obtained. So we have a more plausibly genuine random number, random generation of spin axes, in which the whole process from generating the choice to carrying out the measurement on the left and the right are isolated from one another by space-like separation. And again, we have, allowing for experimental error, strong agreement with predictions of quantum mechanics and enormous disagreement with the predictions of the EPR criterion, in this case 16 standard deviations away. Other questions on all this? On this? How convinced are you by the experimental data?
Sixteen standard deviations
is good. That's I guess that's not. If you accept the interpretation of the experiment, then and you accept that 16 sigma represents how well it disagrees, then I think it's fairly clear you should be persuaded.
Would Einstein have been convinced? Because, I mean, he didn't believe in the randomness of quantum physics, then he doesn't believe in the setup to get random, and then you're back to square one, or am I missing?
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I think it's a fascinating question, actually, how Einstein's thoughts would have evolved through to the present day. Let's not try and speak for Einstein directly. But the line of argument, I think, is right. We still need to assume that that genuinely random numbers are being created by these quantum random number generators. And yet the game we're playing is trying to exclude some theory that underlies quantum theory that indeed makes deterministic predictions. And there's a tension there. I mean, it's not clear that it's really a tension we can actually eliminate entirely.
I agree with it because
I wasn't criticizing. I wasn't trying to speak for you either. Yeah. I was just sort of elaborating the thought. Let me try and express something like the median consensus view. I mean, you will get different views on this. But something like the median consensus view is, among people who care about these questions in the first place, is, first, let's respect to EPR. As my colleague in Cambridge, Jeremy Butterfield, he says, the EPR argument is a damn good argument. I mean, the criteria are plausible. They look like reasonable demands to make on our theory. They're not beyond question, but they're very plausible. We can try to do more and more sophisticated experiments that close all the possible logical loopholes. We can't succeed in the end in closing every possible loophole in an experiment. You can always find some story that will, in principle, allow the EPR criterion to survive despite experimental data that appear to conflict. At some point, so there's motivation to push as far as you can in closing these loopholes. Partly because even if you're almost sure that you've got the answer right, you want to be as confident as you can. Partly just for technological reasons. It's an interesting technological challenge. But at some point, the law of diminishing returns sort of kicks in, and you feel you just have to accept what nature on the face of it seems to be telling you. And you bear in mind, okay, there's a logical possibility that some deeply conspiratorial underlying theory is fooling us. But it's hard to produce anything that looks plausible or elegant, that would do the job. So I think most people are by now very, very convinced that quantum theory is right on this point and the criteria are wrong. And yet at the same time, if one's a good scientist, one maintains a sliver of doubt and a sliver of interest and a wish, at least an openness to possibly new ideas. Maybe somebody, I can't think of a really good theory that respects the EPR criteria and explains all experiments to date. But maybe I've missed something. Maybe somebody has some story that I haven't thought of that hasn't yet been considered by the community, but might yet be worth testing. However, for the moment, quantum mechanics seems to have prevailed. Most people's bets would be quantum mechanics will continue to prevail on this point. I this is maybe a good point, place to stop for this morning. I could describe a couple more experimental probes, but maybe I'll just give you the references to those and in the lecture notes and let you look them up yourselves. Are there more questions? Okay, so let's continue on.